Accession number 27185, reel 65.
Major Barras, reel 65.
I think you were saying you were advised to apply to British Electric Traction to see if you could find a post there.
Yes, I was actually, I was asked to go to an interview where I saw a gentleman by the name Mr. Beddow, I remember, who was managing director of BET, who used to own all the trams, private companies all around the country. And then, of course, they turned into trolley buses, and then they turned into coaches and buses. And he informed me that at that time there weren't any suitable vacancies in Associated Rediffusion. But would I be interested in going on the bus side? So after a long talk, he said, well, I'll arrange for you to go for an interview with British Midland Red, based in Birmingham, which eventually turned out, and I did. I went and saw the general manager there. And the upshot of it was he very kindly offered me a job there as management training a year ahead, which was something I wasn't expecting, because there aren't many idiots around the place who offer you a job a year ahead. And he offered it at a salary which was accepted in those days of £1,000 a year, which was acceptable in those days. I remember him saying to me, are you prepared to take orders from me? And here's a man sitting up there as general manager of a company which had a staff of 10,000 and 2,000 buses and coaches. So I naturally said, yes, sir. So I got a bit of paper from him, which I was able to send to the Adjutant General's department, which was Nigel Gribben, in fact, who I mentioned before. And then they very kindly said, OK, you can be released, but you can't go until the spring of 1959, which I knew anyway. So I still had some time to do in the War Office. In fact, a whole year. So at the end of... the beginning of 1957, going back a bit, we had a new AQMG. Brindley somebody, can't remember his surname unfortunately, of the Leicesters left. We weren't really sorry to see him go. He was a bit, little bit of a poser. I really didn't get to know him very well because he wasn't there terribly long. His place was taken by Lieutenant Colonel Wood of the Royal Tank Regiment, who was an excellent AQMG. He was a heavily built but not very tall gentleman with a black moustache, black hair. Great sense of humour, knew his job, interested in people, we all thought we'd got something much better than we had before. I never understood. I often thought about him squeezing himself in and out of a tank. I also marvelled at his lunchtime menu, because we used to at lunchtime either go off down to the pub locally, and his diet was about three or four sausages all washed down by Guinness, and that's all he had.
Which pub did you use?
I can't. The Two Chairmen was one, I think.
The Two Chairmen, that's on the edge of Trafalgar Square, isn't it?
Yes.
Off the edge.
Yes, there was another one not far away that we used to use. Once or twice I went into the canteen in the main War Office building, but I didn't have many meals there. It was typical sort of Windsor brown soup, shepherd's pie, and heavy treacle pudding with hot custard on it. When I got back to the office, I just wanted to go to sleep. Anyway, it wasn't my idea of lunch.
Sausages and Guinness be a rather soporific diet?
Well, yes, I don't know how he managed it. But a lot of the time I used to go off and have a meal in this, and very often met some mates who I knew in the army, who directorates or somebody outside the army. He proved a great improvement. He was a great improvement on our previous boss. Of course, so this time we gradually stopped working on Saturdays. When I first went there, we worked on Saturday mornings. And then, of course, the civil servants union got the day, rest of the day off. So there wasn't any point in us going in, so we didn't work on Saturdays after a time. I don't know whether I mentioned before that we moved to Chipstead.
You were saying you moved to a better house.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, we most of our leaves at that time were spent... We did go to Jersey once, I remember, but we used to go up to Hingham to my people. I don't think I mentioned that one of the celebrities there was Field Marshal Ironside, who lived in the village as one of my father's church wardens. And we used to go and pay the old boy a visit every time I went up, and whilst he stood towering over me, maybe 6 foot 4 inches or whatever it was, he was now in his late 70s, I think. He always insisted we took the children, so they went along, and he always got his medals out for them to play with. And I always remember whenever I went there, he always used to say to me, "What's the army thinking now?" Which is a very broad question, a very difficult one to answer by a major to a field marshal, so I found it very difficult to answer his question.
What did anything particular interest him at that time? What did he direct
I can't remember now. It may have done. I can still remember Stats being there and seeing him and the children sitting on the sofa there playing, and she was sweet, I remember. Because he died in 1959 and didn't get his piper, did he, at his funeral, which he wanted.
Do you remember him saying anything about his reminiscences of the Second World War?
No, I don't. I don't. I'm not sure that he would have wanted to have imparted them to me. I mean, he was well known for his heading the British... army, or part of the army, which was fighting on the side of the White Russians, wasn't he?
He went north...
Archangel.
Went to North Russia in 1919.
Archangel, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But then, of course, he was chief of the Imperial General Staff at the outbreak of the...
That's right, yeah.
Second World War.
Yeah.
I wondered if he had said anything about that.
Yeah, he didn't,
been
no.
active at that
no.
time.
No, he didn't. Because he was very quickly replaced, wasn't he, just after, or during Dunkirk,
yes.
or after Dunkirk.
Yes. Dill came in to replace him.
Who, Dill, that's
John
right,
Dill.
Yes. Yeah. Before he went to the States.
He went to America to be replaced by Alan Brooke.
Alan Brooke, mm. yeah, that's right. Mm. Yeah, no, he was very nice. I was surprised he died so soon after, actually, because he seemed in very fit and well. Mm. Whilst we were there, Anne's brother, Rolf, who had been in Accra, came home ill. He got multiple cirrhosis and he's slowly going downhill, and he was living with his wife and two young children. Anne's mother and father came back from Jamaica, where they'd been living, to see him, and we used to visit them now and again, and I never ceased to admire his cheerful courage, although he couldn't shave, he couldn't feed himself, he couldn't even cuddle his children. But he was always he was always so cheerful, you could hardly understand what he said. He sadly died, probably a happy release, I should think, from his point of view, but he was only 29, which was...
very young.
He is my wife's twin, actually. They were twins. And so after his death, my father and mother-in-law moved to Jersey, where my father-in-law, Tony Bertram, had been born. He came from a long line of Jerseymen. So after that, we were able to go there and spend many of our summer holidays in Jersey. In fact, it became sort of our second home, really. I regard that as my second home, and Jamaica as my third home, although I'm not sure I would want to go back now. So, we've discussed the question of my early retirement, haven't we?
Yes, and you managed to get it fixed through...
That's right. I have to say that I did it with a lot of heart-searching, because I love the army. On the other hand, I don't think I'd ever been overly ambitious. I wasn't an earnest, ambitious officer. I never sort of could see myself, I don't ever sort of thought of myself as a general or carrying a field marshal's baton in my haversack. I just did jobs that came up and did them to the best of my ability and was happy to do them. And then sort of I knew what I wanted to do. I preferred to be on the general staff when it came to, I like to be at the centre of things. And therefore I was glad when I was an adjutant or serving in general staff appointments. I wasn't an AQ type or a QM type, really, although it was interesting to get to know about it, because I think if you're going to serve on the general staff, then you should know about these things and not rely on other people to supply all the information all the time, although of course you have to go to technicians to get information, technical people, and not try and bluff it through yourself.
I think you indicated earlier on, though, that you would like to have commanded your battalion.
Oh, I certainly would, yes. And I got the feeling, obviously, that as I think I mentioned, miraculously, I was on the A list of the army. And I don't think they were going to keep me there for 16 years as a major. So, and although I got my recommendation, there's no doubt that unless I've messed things up completely somewhere, I would have got promotion to lieutenant colonel. How far I'd have gone after that, I just don't know. But of course, so many battalions, so many regiments had closed down, and the opportunities of commanding a battalion were coming slimmer and slimmer. The colonial ones were all going. Being in command of a TA battalion didn't really appeal to me. I would have considered myself very lucky if I'd been appointed to it. But I felt there was there was not enough. I liked being with regular soldiers if I could be, or national service, because they turned out absolutely excellent, most of them. But being on a sort of half short-term or ad hoc situation, as one would be, I thought, in a TA, just going to the drill hall once a week or whatever it was, having cocktail parties and the social side. I like my fellow humans and beings, but I don't like too much of the socialising. It's also artificial, a lot of it, I find. So I don't know whether the opportunity would have presented itself to be commander of the battalion. If I hadn't got a battalion, then presumably I could have got something on the staff side and gone up on the staff side.
Well, if you'd commanded as a lieutenant colonel, that would have opened the way to all sorts of appointments, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would have done, yes, provided I'd proved myself as a battalion commander. But if you don't get command, of course, and you get what's called, something over, passed over.
Yes.
Which is most two words which send shutters down everybody's, all majors' backs. if you get passed over, then you never get the opportunity again, or very seldom do you ever get an opportunity again for getting a command. You might be lucky. But then you're on the staff side. Mm. And you could, okay, you can get up to a full colonel probably on the staff side. Then you could probably be a military attaché, or you could do kinds of other interesting jobs.
Being a military attaché probably involves even more of the artificial type of entertaining than being a TA colonel.
Oh yes, it probably did. I mean, there was always the opportunity of putting a civilian suit on and black glasses and going off around, walking around your host country looking for things, but...
Well, you've done a bit of that anyway, hadn't you, in the Caribbean?
Oh, yes, yes.
Down I'm not sure about the dark glasses, but...
No, I didn't wear dark glasses. what annoyed me... I was disappointed that I couldn't keep my Paul Barlow passport.
It might have been very useful on occasion.
Yes, and I would have had to worn dark glasses, I think.
Did anything happen in that last year then?
Well, not an awful lot, actually.
Because you were making a plan, weren't you? Long-term plan, which you said had to be elaborated.
Well, the Xenophon.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was more or less completed, I think, by the time I'd finished. Well, before I'd finished. I didn't. They gave me odd jobs to do. I can't remember what they were now, but there was always something to do in the War Office, and I'd come round and throw something at
you. Making a case for the abolition of hospitals.
Yes, I did that. Yeah.
I mean, in 1958, there were some interventions going on in the Eastern Mediterranean. Did you have anything to do with the planning for those, or planning for perhaps similar operations in the future?
No. I don't know. That was going on. You mean the Suez?
No, this is 58.
Oh, sorry. Yes, Suez was...
Suez 56.
56, you're quite right.
But, and we put a...
Was it Palestine?
Jordan,
yes. Yes.
The 16th Parachute Brigade Group.
That's right. No, we didn't have anything. I didn't, because I was on the long-term side.
Long-term, yes.
But the other chap who was DAQMG working on the short-term would have been involved in it, I expect.
I think we were also thinking in terms of doing similar sorts of things. These were effectively protective or preemptive deployments.
Yes.
Stop things developing into trouble.
Right.
In other parts of the world, such as Kuwait and...
Yes.
Yes. Do you remember having anything to do with that sort of?
Not really. I probably got involved with helping out, I should think, because the work became pretty heavy on those and the lights used to burn late in the all around the whole of Trafalgar Square there and down the Whitehall. But I can't recall exactly what I did during that time. I think I hadn't exactly switched off, I hope, but. I wasn't registering as earnestly as I would probably have done earlier had I been staying in the army.
Yes.
Because my mind was now...
Looking ahead,
and I wasn't, you know, although I was happy to help and do whatever I was asked to do, it didn't seem to register.
What happened then when you did come to the end of the appointment at the War Office?
Nothing very much, really. One of the things I remember during my last days there was that my bowler hat, which I've been having to wear.
A two-piece bowler hat.
Oh, I did tell you about that, did I?
Yes.
I had to put the brim on, then the crown, and then I had to use two hands to take it off when seeing a general. Yes, I did mention that. One day in the middle of April, 59. I finished my work at 5:30, said goodbye, went round, said goodbye. I think we'd had a few drinks in the pub in the middle of the day, just three of us. Walked out of the War Office, walked out of my job, walked out of the army. I caught the train and went home, and that was it.
Did you start in your new life immediately?
No, I specifically asked if I could have a month's... between coming out of the army and before I started work there to sort of readjust myself. It didn't stop me from one day after I got out of the army, I remember standing and looking out the window thinking, what on earth I'd done.
I was going to ask you whether you found it difficult to adjust to.
Well, I found that talking to other people who come out of the army and civil, they all did that.
Yes.
After they'd been out for a bit, they all sort of stopped and thought, what on earth have I done, you know? I didn't find it too difficult, I don't think, because I got interested and I was immediately immersed in what I had to do. I mean, we continued to rent the house which had been hired from the army, because I could deal direct... Well, I didn't hire it from the army. The army had hired it from a wing commander in the RAF, who was actually in the UK. So we were able to contact him and ask if we could take over the lease, or the... not the rent, rather, the rental, which he very kindly said we could do. So I left my family there to go up to Birmingham to start working there and see how things worked out. I don't know whether you're interested in what I was actually doing there. I can give you a sort of potted version of what the rest of my career was. And
did what you were doing resemble in any way what you'd done while you were in the army, once you got into the...
Nothing. What was very similar was the fact that I'd heard so much about unions and all their disruption and so forth, and I was totally surprised by the loyalty of all the workmen, all the working people inside Midland Red, which are who I came across. The only thing which resembled the army was the fact that I found that personnel officers used to go around trying bus conductors and drivers who had been put on a charge. Now, apparently a driver who didn't set his destination blind correctly could be put on a charge. And I remember, as I think I mentioned before, I went round all the departments there, doing a few weeks in each department. I went with the conductors out on the job, came back and did their cash checking up afterwards. Went into the engineers, and I spent quite a long time going down in pits in overalls and then going to their canteens with them and stuffing myself with pies and all the stuff which was available in the canteen and the war office. And going behind the statistics and the traffic organisation who did all the routings and timetables, and then they had to go to...
That does sound rather like staff work.
Well,
like
it was staff work, yes, because they had to go to the traffic commissioners to get licences to run routes. So that was the most interesting lot, because they were the sort of general staff, really, of the
planning.
Planning, yes. And it's amazing how much work had to be done. I mean, you've got 2,000 vehicles running all over the place. And they were just starting, the only thing which was really of interest, so they were just starting the first express service to London by coach down the M1, which had just been built. And I went on a trial track with one of these going 80 miles an hour around and around the track, which was rather fun.
You wouldn't do that down the M1 these days.
No. But they were the first to start express services to London. But I remember, as I was going to say, I got back to the personnel officers going around, and I sat there behind him. In fact, they got me to deal with one, you know, as the sort of...
Your training.
Part of my training, to try a chap who'd come in and done something. An inspector sat behind me, and after he said, yeah, that was all right. He did that all right, you know, sort of thing. Was I felt I was doing company office. But the first one I went into, I didn't know where to look, because they were obviously a little bit on their formal, because they didn't know quite who I was or what I was. And it was all done. The people living in Birmingham all around there are most delightful, nearly docile sort of people, not like if you go Yorkshire or something where they're probably more outward looking and aggressive. They're very docile, I found, and I was terribly surprised when they all went on strike under Red Robber and ruined their jobs. But anyway, I sat there, and in this sort of accent that they have there, which the personnel officer got a driver who had set his blinds wrong. And he said, well, driver Parkinson, he said, you're on a charge for dilatory blind set in, you see. So the chap sitting in the chair looked at him blankly and said, well, what's dilatory for a start? And I didn't know where to look. I just, for the rest of the time I sat there, I was just sort of coughing away. I don't think I heard what he gave him. He probably gave him seven days CB or something. But I don't know what they could do. I can't remember now.
Could they find them?
They must have done, I suppose. That is the only thing they could do.
Couldn't lock them up, could they?
Yeah, they couldn't lock them up. But they were the most delightful people. I mean, I went round all these departments, and they were all quite open about what they were doing. I was just suspecting they were going to play their cards close to their chest. But they were so warm-hearted people, and I was delighted to be amongst them, really, because they were so charming.
Had most of them served in the forces?
There were some there, yes. There were some who served in during the war. Of course, it's still in the 50s, well,
yes.
Getting on to the 60s.
Served or done national
service. So a lot of them, yes. In fact, I remember when I got down to the next company, where there were still some old soldiers in the amongst the drivers and conductors, that I was asked to put the wreath on the war memorial in Maidstone, which I went to after this, and a lot of them were there, and they all came along with their medals and everything. Yes, there were quite a number of them.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that initially, in the first stages, having left the army, you were feeling a bit lost. wondering what you'd done.
Well, it wasn't so much lost. It was a question of, you know, have I done the right thing?
How long did that feeling last before?
Oh, not too long. I got involved with all this, and of course I was very interested in what was going on. And one of the things which I did was to drive a double-decker bus around Birmingham. At my request, I asked if I could do it, and they very kindly said yes. So, I had to go on a single-decker, which was rigged up for learning drivers, because it had two dual gears.
Dual control.
And it was very difficult to drive, actually, because you had to listen to the engine dying down to a certain stage before you put it into gear. When I got to the double deckers, of course, it was much easier to drive, being 36 foot long. I had to pass my test. A chap from the ministry came down and passed me out, and I still got a badge
as PSP, a public.
Yes. In fact, I've got it here. I'll show it to you afterwards. I'm very proud of it. That and the fact that I was a marksman on the range and got this badge are two of the highlights of my life, I think.
Very important skills.
Yes.
Saleable skills.
Yeah. But I remember when I first started, I think I had a good eye for what I could do and where I could go. And there was the inspector who was teaching me to drive. Of course, he can't sit next to you on a double-decker bus. You're sitting up in front. And he got taken the glass out so he could talk to me. He said, now go here and do this, that, and the other. And I remember occasions I could hear his voice saying, no, 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 from the back, as I was sort of going through a sort of what he considered a too narrow space, which I managed to get through. But in the end, they said, okay. And I remember, yes, the other thing I remember was that I tried to drive it like a car to start with. And he said, the inspector said, just keep going. He said, everybody will get out of your way. He said, don't try and help other people or do anything, just keep going. And it was. I sat up there driving away and everybody cleared out of my way. Luckily for the population of Birmingham, I was never put on to drive the thing on a regular basis. But well, that was rather fun, actually. I enjoyed that. So I didn't join the union, though.
Was there any hint of industrial trouble?
No, none at all when I was there. None at all. I think that a lot of them were going to lose their jobs when the computers came up, because there were so many departments there who were doing analysis, logging, statistics, passenger miles, passenger carried, fuel used, and so forth. And of course now you can feed the whole damn lot into a computer. But there were several departments there that were totally involved with statistics. I mean, you didn't have to be qualified. And one bloke was sitting in the back room just taking figures off one sheet of paper and putting them on another sheet of paper.
Purely mechanical business.
Well, absolutely, yes. But and one or two of them were obviously taking their time doing it, because they realised, I don't blame them, actually, because they felt that if they'd finished and said, right, I've got nothing to do, they'd say, right, you're fired. So they kept. They used to do it so slowly throughout the whole day to keep their jobs. So I didn't feel. I had the greatest sympathy for them, and I didn't feel I could grasp on them. So I let them carry on with it. But I knew. Well, I didn't know at that time. But obviously later they were going to lose their jobs, all of them, because there were computers coming up, and a whole new brand of people would come in all departments. Like what happened in the aviation, which I was to join later. But after I'd been there for nearly a year, I suppose, and I used to go home by train every weekend, and let me go home. After I'd been there for a year, I got a little bit restive. I was appointed to an area manager called Joe Baddon.